Alan.
Yeah?
You're here. I'm here. Let's make a podcast.
Sure.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sudeby. How you doing, Alan?
Excellent. Thank you.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. So, Alan, seems like recording a podcast is just, like, impossible these days.
Oh, really? How do you mean?
Well, I don't know. Just, like, for our last episode, I was, like, sick during the time when we normally would record, so we had to postpone and postpone until we were basically recording the day before we were going to release.
Alaminute, if you will.
Yeah, Alaminute, exactly. And that's pretty much exactly what happened this time, because you were kind of feeling under the weather last week, hey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's weird how... Yeah, that's weird. It's weird how when a close friend is super sick and then you hang out with them a bunch and then you get super sick. I don't know. But it's good. I'm happy because it means that this, when this one's released, it's going to be super fresh.
<It's gonna laughs> That's right.
So topical, so on point, so timely.
I mean, like, it would be so... We would be able to offer a totally different style of content if we always recorded like the day before we were going to release, because then we could do topical things. But,
well, sort of, but it would be, if we actually wanted it to be timely, it would be a lot more work than what we do now, because we'd have to be like, okay, this is happening.
I wasn't
tomorrow
suggesting anything, Alan.
Yeah, I don't want to do it. It sounds terrible.
Speaking of topical, yesterday was Mother's Day. Did you do anything for Mother's Day?
Of course I did. I'm not a monster. I called my mother and I celebrated nice. My wife and the mother of my children by making breakfast and dinner and doing family stuff. And
totally. That's the stuff.
Yeah.
I made breakfast. Yeah. We had my whole family came over here. So my brother and his wife and their kids and my mom and dad and my other brother and my sister were all here, and we had Eggs Benny. That was fun. Yeah.
And the children, actually, too? The children had Eggs Benny?
Yeah. I mean, they're not children. They're like teenagers.
Oh, okay. And they like it?
Yeah. Yeah. They liked it okay. There was a little bit of kind of like apprehension about the Hollandaise sauce, but
right.
I think in the end, everyone bought in. Also, it was the first time sorry, you have a question?
The apprehension about the Hollandaise, just because it's like they think it's raw egg, or it's just like so voluptuous, they've never seen a sauce like that, or what do you mean?
Yeah, just that, you know, like they haven't had it a bunch.
Right.
At least my niece hadn't had it a bunch. And I think when she had it, didn't really like it. Mm-hmm. But obviously it's a different experience when you have someone making it from scratch, like, you know, versus what you might get at like Ricky's or something. I don't know. I'm sure that her experience with Hollandaise is from bad Hollandaise at restaurants.
You really hate Ricky's, do you? I'm just kidding.
Actually, I haven't been to Ricky's more than a decade, so I probably should.
Yeah, me neither. And actually, there was some... Oh, actually, literally yesterday, one of the things that we did on Mother's Day was we went swimming. That's like if we've got a day off, and especially if it's a holiday, because usually the pools aren't very busy, we like to go for a public swim. And so we went to the Bonnie Doon pool, and from where we live, we go down White Avenue all the way to the eastern end of White Avenue. And we go by a place that
lot of restaurants on White Avenue.
Oh, definitely. Oh, we go by, we traverse all of White Avenue to get from where we live to Bonnie Doon. And there was a place around Mill Creek that was a Humpty's, which I don't even know if they exist anymore, but now it's a Ricky's.
Yeah, not sure. Right. But it's only half a Ricky's or something.
Oh, is it?
From what I understand, it's going to be half a Ricky's and half something else, but I can't remember what the something else is right now.
Oh, really? I didn't notice that.
Yeah, so I don't know. I guess Ricky's has some kind of deal with some other restaurant chain, and they're going to, it's going to be like a shared space or a half and half or something.
I drove by. I know, just thinking about the, like, if you've lived in an area long enough to know the kind of like ancestry and genealogy of a certain location, I drove by one place really close to Nate, actually. It's like Princess Elizabeth and 97th-ish. It used to be a Boston Pizza, and it's one of those places that just from the architecture of the building, you can tell what it used to be, like kind of like Pizza Hut vibes. Like it has a it has a roof and a roof structure that you can just tell what business it used to be. Pizza Hut, Arby's, whatever. This used to be a Boston Pizza, but now it's a daycare. But it, like, the facade is almost like, the facade is just like a early 2000s Boston Pizza, but it now, instead of that logo, it has like a fun, colorful, kid-friendly daycare logo on it. And where the patio was, now it's like an enclosed play space for kids. But
cool. Let me see if you know about this little piece of restaurant location ancestry.
You're going to say Punjabi's, right?
No. Oh, no, okay. No, but yeah, that definitely used to be an Arby's. That's another good restaurant trivia tidbit for Edmontonians.
For people who live in South Edmonton, yeah.
Yeah. Now Ricky's, nay Humpty's, used to be another restaurant.
Okay.
Are you aware of what that restaurant used to be?
I mean, I would guess a Denny's, but no, it's not really. I'll just tell you, I've lived in the White Avenue area the entire time that I've lived in Edmonton, but it's been what's delicately called West White Avenue West. However, I worked at Color Divino, which is literally across the street from the place we're talking about.
What was a Humpty's? Yeah.
But that was circa 2016. So no, it was always a Humpty's to me. What is it? What was it?
It's interesting. It was an Earl's.
Really?
Originally, when it was built.
Mm-hmm.
And that building was the original Earl's restaurant.
No. What? I thought Earl's was from Vancouver.
I'm pretty sure not. I mean, I could do a quick Google right now, but I'm pretty sure that Earl's
you better
was
do that
born
right now.
I mean, like, I probably should, since I'm like, since I'm so confidently putting it out there as a piece of information on our show. But yeah, I'm pretty sure that restaurant location was the original Earl's restaurant. And if you'll just bear with me for 1 second, tappity tap tap tap.
We do need to look into that, because you know what, like when my parents and brother and sister moved to Alberta when I was 12, or I was about to turn 12, and the first place that we ate in Alberta was Earl's. And so in my mind for a few years, Earl's was an Alberta thing. But then after hearing and reading about it more, I thought for sure that it was from Vancouver.
Okay. This is from the Earl's website.
Sounds legit. Okay.
So if it's not accurate, it's at least sanctioned by the business.
Right.
Well, this is interesting. This piece of information half corroborates what I'm saying.
Okay.
The family moved to West Vancouver in the 70s, where they've stayed ever since. It was after this final move that Bus, his eldest son Stan, staying true to their roots, started the first joint venture. When this restaurant opened, there was no question what name it would be called. It had to be called Earl's. There's a bunch of context for that.
Okay.
And so the first Earl's opened in 1982 on Calgary Trail in Edmonton.
Not even close. We're talking about Mill Creek and White Avenue.
I think it's incorrect. I'm like almost positive that White Ave location was the very first Earl's. I'm like
there is an Earl's on Calgary Trail right now in White Mud Crossing, not at Mill Creek.
Yeah. So I don't think that existed in 1982. I don't think there was a White Mud Crossing in 1982.
it was just Aspen and Parkland, and there were antelope and buffalo. I think that Edmonton went that far south in 1982.
It did. There was a White Mud Drive in 1982. Although I'll say, like, so, well, and there was, yeah, like there were a lot of South Edmonton neighborhoods in 1982. Right. But like, Mill Woods was being built in the late 70s and early 80s. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Looks like I'm wrong, I guess. I don't know where I got that information from, but I'm finding another source here that's saying that the first Earl's restaurant was on Calgary Trail and not on White Ave. And so, I don't know.
Apart from the Earl's website, you mean?
Yeah. This is from Edify magazine. It's in Edmonton magazine. So there's a story in Edify about the origins of Edmonton chain restaurants, of which Boston Pizza is also apparently one.
That's true. Yeah. But I'm highly skeptical. So you've already like mentioned an internet site that says the first Earl's was on Calgary Trail. And then
that's right.
Edify.
And then Edify also says the same thing. Yeah.
But they don't give any source for like the Earl's website says that the first restaurant that was branded Earl's was in Edmonton on Calgary Trail. Right.
That's right.
But the Edify one doesn't give a source for why they say the first one is on Calgary Trail, right?
Let me check. Let me see if they name any sources here. I appreciate your thoroughness, Alan.
They're not
citing any sources here. This is just could be purely anecdotal information.
Or it could be ripped
straight from the Earl's restaurant.
Well, that's what I mean. Website. Someone did the exact same internet search that you did and then thought that because they were a journalist, they could just write it without a source. I had the exact same thing happen to me today where I was like, I read a quote and it gave a source and I was like, I don't know if that is correct, or at least I'm interested in corroborating that, and then did an intercept and it wasn't right. It wasn't, I don't know.
Okay. It'll have to be follow up then. I will do sure. some additional research because I don't know. Like I remember eating in that restaurant when it was in Earl's, like
in the Mill Creek Humpties. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. That's right, in the Mill Creek Humpties. Yeah, when it was in Earl's. And it was covered in parrots, dude.
Okay.
There was a thousand wooden parrots in there.
As it should be.
And
in the 90s, right? I mean, not because every... What? Earl started in the 80s?
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you sure?
How can I be?
Exactly.
How can I be when I need like footnotes and I need like 30 different sources and...
I mean, if we weren't recording this, I wouldn't care. I would just want to hear what the parrots looked like. But because we're recording it, I feel like maybe it should be truthful.
No, you're right. It should be. I just can't provide any additional
truth. I got it.
Any additional truth at this time. This time, it's all conjecture based on my foggy memory of eating in that restaurant in the 80s.
Which Earl's location in Edmonton is known as Tin Palace? Where is that, or was that, or what?
Yeah, it was downtown in the same location where the Jasper Ave Earl's currently is, but it was just a very different structure. It was all shiny kind of like steel cladding on the outside of the building.
Mm.
And so they called it Earl's Tin Palace. It was a pretty fancy building for back in the day. It definitely stood out when you're like driving down Jasper Ave. It was like,
yeah,
different from everything around it. So that was interesting.
Like the
Earl's
West
Tin Palace,
the west side of Jasper somewhere, right? Like west of 16th.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Wait. Anyway, getting back to Mother's Day.
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah.
Can you believe that we're back at Mother's Day? I made English muffins for the first time.
Oh, really? Did you fork split them?
No, it was much easier to cut them.
Disappointing. Just kidding.
Sorry about that.
It's fine. It's just a funny thing that
I tried fork splitting a couple, but like they got like, I think they were too warm when I tried to fork split them. Mm. Like they were still too warm from being cooked. And so it just kind of like pushed. I think I had to like let them cool for 20 minutes or something if I wanted to try to fork split them, because they were just like too soft on the inside. And that was just like putting the fork in was just like smashing up the warm bready in interior of it. So I wound up having to cut them with a knife, but they were good. But they were also, I need to take another crack at it, because like when I cooked them in the pan, they were beautiful. But then after I took them out, they really started to deflate and they wound up being like fairly thin. So I'm not quite sure if I just didn't. Well, could be a couple things. Thing one is I just didn't produce enough gluten when I was kneading them. So they didn't quite have as much structure as they should. Thing two, I think, is just like I let them rise in the fridge overnight, but then like the following day, I didn't have a ton of time to allow them to rise out of the fridge. And so when I cut them, they were probably 3/4 of an inch thick, and they probably should have been more like 1 1/4 inches or something when I put them in the pan, and then they would have puffed up like huge, but then they would have sunk back down to like what I think would be the normal thickness. So yeah, just not quite thick enough, I think, was the main problem. But yeah, it worked out really well. They were super tasty. I've always loved like freshly made English muffins. They're just so much better. Like there are a lot of things that when you make them at home, like they're better maybe in a way, or they're better because they're like, you know, a recipe that's like well known to you. And so there's the comfort of having something that you don't get to have anywhere else or something like that. But I think, you know, in a lot of cases when you make things at home that you would normally buy at the store, you know, sometimes it's hard to replicate the like quality of something that you get in the store, but like for English muffins, it's just like they are so, so much better if you make them by hand. It's not even the same product.
Did you fry them in pans or on a griddle, or what were you working
with? Yeah, in cast iron skillets. I have 2 cast iron skillets. One's like 12 inches and one's like 10. So I could fit like 3 or 4 of them in the 10 inch one and like 5 of them in the 12 inch one. Yeah, so that was good. That really made the Benny's, I think, like, you know, a Benny's a Benny, and the Hollandaise can be kind of like good or bad or whatever, but you know, and I mean, I guess you can have good or bad eggs too actually, but Benny's definitely not a Benny.
did your Hollandaise come out of a siphon, and did your eggs come out of a circulator? That's what I'd like to know. Your mother's Neither.
Oh, neither.
My goodness.
Yeah, I made the Hollandaise in the traditional method by whisking hot melted butter into a sabayon type egg yolk thickened sauce.
Not because of you, but I really hoped that you said I made the Hollandaise in the traditional manner where I whisked powdered Hollandaise into what? I don't know. I knew you wouldn't say it, but for some reason I thought maybe you would say it as a joke.
Man, that would have been amazing if you could buy Hollandaise powder at the grocery store. Can you? Maybe you can. I don't know.
I don't know about the grocery store, but you can definitely order it from a supplier.
Oh yeah,
a distributor.
For sure. Yeah. When I was growing up, we often had Hollandaise. My dad would make Hollandaise sauce for some breakfasts or some dinners that we had, and he had like a tried and true blender Hollandaise recipe that he would make. Where, I mean, it's basically the same thing. You heat up the butter, so that it's hot and melted. And then you put the egg yolks and lemon juice. It's just egg yolks and lemon juice and a little bit of salt in the blender. And then you just turn on the blender and drizzle in the butter while it's hot. And you wind up with hollandaise sauce.
Yeah.
So that style of hollandaise sauce is like the, like, you know, the mode that, that I probably have some like nostalgia comfort attached to. And so like normal hollandaise sauce, like traditional hollandaise sauce where you make a gastrique and then put egg yolks into it and then whisk in the butter, it always tastes like so different from that. So I'm always like, oh, does this taste like good hollandaise? I can never tell. But but yeah, it was good. And I just poached the eggs, normal styles. It's just so easy to, like, I mean, I've known this for a long time because I used to cook brunch a lot, but like Eggs Benny is popular because people enjoy eating it or whatever. It's like, you know, it's like a really rich comfort food type of meal. And I understand why people like it.
Yeah.
But the reason why it's popular is, I think, more because of how easy it is to make a whole lot of it. Like, you know, the reason why it's on tons of menus and it's like on banquet menus and things like that is because it's so easy to replicate in a way where you can just make so much of it all at once. Cause you can poach eggs in batch and you can heat it, and then you can hold the hollandaise in batch. And then basically all you're doing is it's like making a sandwich or something as far as line cooking goes or short order cooking goes. It's just like such an easy thing to put together once you have the components ready to roll.
Huh. I haven't thought about it that way, but maybe I should just change my way of thinking. Cause usually like if you're poaching the eggs a la minute and you're making hollandaise from scratch, to me that's kind of onerous, but maybe I'm just not thinking about the right way.
I mean, like, maybe onerous at first when you are not used to poaching 30 eggs at a time or something like that, but there's no, I mean, I guess you can make 30 scrambled. Honestly though, like making 30 poached eggs I think is easier than making 30 scrambled eggs and having them be good. Like making 30 scrambled eggs and having them be good and not have them like leak liquid or be too soft or too hard, or that's really tricky. But 30 poached eggs, like you have a bath that's simmering, you know, so the water's moving, you gently drop them in, you set a timer, you pull them out, they're good to go. And, you know, and then there are even more tricks than that. You can poach your eggs ahead. So, you know, like you can poach them in batch and then cool them down and then reheat them to order and things like that. Like there's a lot of shortcuts that you can take too that just make it even easier. And like, you know, obviously it's both things. If it was like a dish that everyone hated, then it wouldn't matter how easy it was to make a lot of it or something. You know, like obviously it's also because it's like a classic dish and the flavors work really well and people really enjoy it. But like, I think the reason why it's so popular is because it's on so many menus, because it's really easy to execute once you have the equipment and the execution down. It's just like, you can pump out so many of them.
And if you didn't have it on your brunch menu, literally no one would ever come to your restaurant, right?
Yeah. So that's, I guess, from the other side. You kind of have to provide it too. So
that could be an interesting topic too. Like things that you can't not have on your menu in a given context. Topic. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Like, you know, I'm sure we probably shouldn't go off on this tangent right now, or we're going to like use up all of the discussion that we would use for that topic. But I can think of a bunch of examples off the top of my head right now where that line of thinking definitely makes sense. Anyways, I feel like we do have a topic.
Oh yeah, what's
that? Mother's Day. Well, do you want me to introduce it? I'll do my best. It's kind of your topic, but I'll see if I can.
It might be fun if you introduce it.
Yeah, exactly. We'll see how dumb I sound. So recently, let's back up a little bit. Alan, your current job, I guess, is you are the instructor for evening dining at Nate. And so you make the menu for and teach the students who prepare the food for Ernest's dining room for their evening dinner service.
Yeah.
And that's what you've been doing for the last 3 years. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, 3.5. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Not to sound too much like a toddler where they correct you for saying, like when you say, oh, you're 3 years old. Well, actually, I'm 3.5.
Yeah.
But it has been, it's been.
And then you say, how old do you think I am? And then they're like, 3.5. Since... A friend of mine, Candace, found out like last week that when her teacher asked her daughter at school how old she thought her, well, I think it's preschool, but anyways, she asked her daughter how old she thought her mom was, and she said 2. So.
Like younger than the kid, like the kid thought that her mom was younger than her. Is that?
Oh, okay. Yeah, but I don't know if she really knows how old she is. Either, right. But cool. Yeah.
Well, anyways, not to quibble, but yeah, it's been since
3.5,
January 2021. So it's been 3.5 years,
three and a half. So you're almost 4.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then, I guess, so, and there's a, policy at Nate where, the instructors only stay in their current assignment for 3 year, for like a 3 year period. Is that right?
It's definitely not a, an institution policy. It's just, it's just something that happens within the culinary department. Usually that
I see
usually so it, every 3 years,
it's not necessarily a policy that applies to everyone. Maybe if someone really likes their assignment and they really don't want to have to change their assignment, then maybe they, you know, can talk to somebody and not have to change their assignment or something like that. But generally, the instructors move around, and teach different classes, I guess, to keep things kind of fresh for the instructors and to keep things fresh for the students and to help, I'm assuming, to keep the staff of instructors learning new skills and broadening their the scope of things that they could possibly teach to the students in the future. Does that kind of sum it up?
I think so. Yeah. I think that's well said. I don't think there's an official policy, but I think that, you've described the intention well, as far as I can tell. Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. And so, because of that, you're going to be, moving off of your current assignment at evening dining and taking over a different set of coursework, yeah, that you're going to be starting to teach in the fall. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And that department, or the department that you're going to be teaching in now, is garde manger.
Yeah. It's the same department, but it's a new course. And so, gotcha. Yeah, it's like, the evening dining course was a fourth semester. So like the, students who are in their last term of full-time culinary arts, they would take this evening dining class. And, now I'm going to be teaching, garde manger, which is a third semester course, which, yeah, the third semester is actually quite interesting in full-time culinary at Nate, because it's three sets of courses that are, the labs are all side by side by side, and they're all, mm-hmm, they all contribute in one way or another to the lunch services in the dining room on campus at Ernest.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Roughly broken into appetizers, entrees, and desserts, but yeah, with very different, learning outcomes and skill sets, I guess, to develop.
Right. So third semester lunch, fourth semester dinner.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And so in the lead up to you taking over the garde manger instruction, you've been, I guess, what, preparing course materials, preparing, doing research to figure out what types of things that you want to, what types of preparations you want to include. I'm sure there's like a curriculum that you, wherein there are certain things that you have to teach, and but probably the dishes that you use to teach those techniques to some extent are up to you. Is that?
Yeah, Shale, you're doing a really great job of describing this. Why don't you just carry? I'm just kidding.
Peace.
So first of all, like, obviously this is a course that's existed in one form or another for decades at Nate. Like I took an iteration of this course when I was a student.
Right.
And so even though it's new to me, like I'm inheriting years and even decades worth of like course structures and material and a standard text that's been used, again, since I was a student and stuff like that. But the actual process that I'm going through, and we can get into different parts of this as you, see fit, Shale, but, so first of all, like going into a new school year, the first thing that happens is that you review the course outline, which, enumerates the learning outcomes of the class, which are to varying degrees static. Like you can tweak them here and there, but in a lot of ways, what we teach is dictated by, for instance, the any provincial exam that students need to write. Like we need to align with the provincial learning objectives so that we're teaching our students the content they need. Yeah, basically, like they're writing a series of exams to get their journeyman certificate and then to become Red Seal chefs. So that's the kind of first thing. Like when you're the instructor of a course going into a new academic year, you review the learning outcomes. But also, like we do have there's this element kind of like we've been talking like really for the last few years. I'll write a menu for evening dining. Because that class is geared towards doing dinner services in the dining room at Nate. This garde manger class, it provides the appetizers for the a la carte lunch services at Ernest. And so there is that element of like writing a menu, making recipes, making prep lists, training students on the stations and the dishes, a bit of a smaller scale because it's just the appetizers instead of a full menu. But there is, in this case with garde manger, like, there's a lot of, learning outcomes that the students really need to practice and execute in addition to the regular service.
Right.
So for evening dining, it was like the learning outcomes were do the dinner service. Basically it was like, like prepare and serve dishes in a fine dining restaurant and manage a fine dining brigade. And that was basically it. But this one, there's more outcomes and they're much more clearly defined than for evening dining. And so
in terms of actual cooking techniques or dishes or something like that.
Yeah. In terms of classical technique. And so like to give, well, I can run through the outcomes for you if you want.
Let's do it.
Are you ready? How much time do you have? The way that I was able, I didn't really change the outcomes, but I kind of reorganized them a bit. And so there are six outcomes for this course. And the first one is quite expansive, so bear with me. It's cold sauces. So sorry, does everybody know what garde manger means? Do we need to start
there? That's a good question.
Okay.
Yeah, what the heck does garde manger? I'm guarding a manger.
Oh boy, is that the name of the episode, Shale?
It is now.
Garde manger, it literally means keep to eat, but it has its roots in old European kitchens where there was a dedicated cold kitchen, a kind of larder or pantry where cold foods were kept. And they did all of the cold food preparation, especially things like cured, smoked, dried, foods, pâtés, terrines, sausages, things like that. That's the classical meaning. In the contemporary kitchen, it's been expanded quite a bit to encompass all of what I just said, but also basically your appetizers. So hors d'oeuvres, right. Amuse-bouche, small bits and bites, and your formal appetizers in an a la carte setting. So there are certain foods that are cooked to order, like fresh protein cooked to order. But even in a modern kitchen, usually, or often anyways, your appetizers are coming off of a station called the garde-manger. Yeah, so it's quite broad, but the classical meaning has to do with cold food and charcuterie.
Alan, I'm shocked that the word salad hasn't come out of your mouth yet.
Well, okay, so learning outcome one. Are you ready?
You bet.
It's expansive. Cold sauces, cold soups, salads, condiments, and pickles. That's the first.
Whoa, that is broad.
It is super broad. And I can rush to defend it, but I think once you hear the other outcomes, you'll agree that these are the things that should be grouped together. Cold sauces, cold soups, salads, condiments, and pickles. Outcome two is cheese. Understanding its production method, how we classify it and describe it and how to serve it, and also how to produce some of the fresh and soft ripened cheeses that are easily produced in a commercial kitchen. Outcome three is cured and smoked foods, as well as fresh sausage. That too, to me, is like an entire universe that is just kind of condensed into one outcome. Outcome four is pâtés, terrines, galantines, and roulades.
Oh, interesting.
Very closely adjacent to charcuterie, to cured and smoked foods and sausages.
Right. Especially the sausage part of that, you know, like the difference between like saying sausage and, you know, a farce or something is like, you know, that's a very tenuous. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You
know, and the truth is that this structure of the six outcomes that I'm describing to you, I've written, but I've just taken, like, it's all the same pieces that have been there for years and years in culinary school.
Right.
And I've just tried to align them differently. And so, for instance, like condiments and pickles used to not be associated with the cold sauces outcome, but it made more sense to me to just shove them there than to where they were before. But
Well, definitely when you say condiments and you say cold sauces, those two things I think have a lot of overlap. So
yeah. Like, how is a condiment not a sauce shell? How is mustard not a sauce? Tell me how mustard is not a sauce.
But then like, what is a okay, let's finish the outcomes first before we start getting philosophical about the difference between a condiment and a sauce.
The fifth outcome is hors d'oeuvres and appetizers, which is
okay. So things that are basically a la minute preparations or something.
Yeah, or small portion. Yeah exactly. Yeah. And the sixth outcome right now is cold buffet. It's buffet service of garde-manger items.
Okay.
So I don't know. In a way, that could be like the actual techniques besides the actual planning and display and service of a buffet, like they could be encompassed in all of those previous outcomes. But because the lunch services at Ernest at Nate, like there's a buffet service almost every Friday of the year or of the school year, and so that kind of needs to be worked into the outcomes for the classes who are involved in those. So
right.
And it does, it is a particular style of service that has its own kind of concerns.
Right. So I would say like the first four outcomes are sort of about the techniques for food production. And then the last two outcomes are sort of more service based, like the
that's preparation. Right.
Yeah.
And actually like I just kind of organized them that way because I intend to have three stations in the class. One of those stations will just be called the service station. And through the week, they'll be doing the a la carte service. using components that are prepped by the other stations. And they'll be on Fridays or whenever there's a Friday buffet, they'll be laying out, like organizing and laying out and replenishing the buffet. And to me, the two outcomes of, say, cured smoked sausage preparations and pâtés and terrines, like, to me, that's just charcuterie. Mm-hmm. And so... Yeah.
So you just spread charcuterie out over two of the
So there's two different outcomes, but there will be one station that all the students rotate through, and it's just called the charcuterie station, and they focus on the preparations involved with those two outcomes. And then there'll be, I've kind of like unromantically just called it the cold kitchen station, where it's like the cold sauces, the cheese boards, the condiments and pickles and salads and everything like that. So,
and so most of the prep. So
yeah, basically
most of the prep of the,
yeah.
Cool. And so when you were taking the garde manger course, are there things that you are like nostalgic about that you want to, make sure that the students get to do? Are there things that like were being taught when you took the course, which are no longer really being taught, that you're like, damn, we should bring that back?
Okay. So boots on the ground as a student, I don't remember this course super well. However,
fair. I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that actually, because I know that charcuterie is kind of your jam.
Well, I was going to say, like, it's actually played a this scope of learning has been pretty important to my time in industry in one way or another. Like, I've taught sausage making classes mm-hmm. for years and years before I started at Nate. Always loved making sausage. Was part of the briefly lived Zaltz Bratwurst House experience. And then the last place I worked before going to Nate, at June's Delicatessen, like, we were curing our own corned beef and smoked meat and stuff like that. So, like, it's something that's, it's been a love of mine for many years. The actual course that I took in culinary school, I think even if I remember a lot of the theory and stuff, I don't remember the course particularly well. I don't know why that is. Well, I mean, because it was a long time ago, but, and so for me, like, I want to organize this class. Like, I want to deliver the content as best I can, dynamically as I can, and then make sure the services go well, that the buffets are fun. That's a humdrum answer, but that's what I got.
No, that's totally reasonable. I just thought there might be something, you know, like I thought that there might be something back there where you're like, oh man, when I get my hands on that garde manger.
Well, the thing is, okay, I guess one thing is that on the surface, this could seem like, you know, we've talked about, you know, chauffeur platters and fat sculptures and stuff like that, where it's like, is this what, if we're really trying to integrate culinary school into contemporary hospitality industry, is this what they should be learning? Should we really be teaching students how to make ice sculptures? Probably not. And on the surface, garde manger kind of reeks of that, where it's like, okay, galantines, chauffoir would
be pâté en croûte.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so what I like, right now, I'm just trying to get a handle on the material, make sure I do it well. The truth is that in the back of my mind, I think that this is super contemporary. Like, it's obviously it's classical, and you probably, you know, you won't get pâté en croûte at Earl's. But if you look at, say, some of the, I know it's not exactly like, you know, this isn't something that's happening this year or in the last couple of years, but like, we've talked about the 11 Mass and Park cookbook.
Yeah.
Like, there are so many classic garde manger techniques in that book, and not even just techniques, but like dishes that have just been reimagined in a contemporary way that are straight out of classic garde manger. And I'm and yes, pâtés and terrines, certainly foie gras terrines, but even say things like working with aspic, like coating sauces, like aspic glazes. Is like when I was going through culinary school, I was like, this is from the 19th century. I will never see this again. I'm not interested in it. But you know, like the foie, a lot of the not like foie gras pâtés or rillettes that are pressed in terrines or whatever in the 11 Mass in Part cookbook circa 2011, like they have gelée caps on them. And so it's like a very classic technique. It's just been reimagined. Instead of a pâté en croûte with a clear aspic glaze on it, you have a, say, a rillette en terrine that has a violet mustard gelée cap and is sliced and has a different presentation or whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you say something or when you evoke something like chaufroid, like that really does, I mean, as much as it's like a classical preparation that you'd never see anywhere or, you know, or like when you imagine, you know, like platters that are decorated with gelées and things with like, you know, intricately presented like vegetable slices underneath an aspic or something like that, you know, you think of like these, you know, classical banquets or something like that. But, you know, in reality, like those types of techniques and the precision that's required to make them look perfect and, you know, to not, I don't know, dumb things like not have air bubbles in them and have everything set, you know, in the position that it's supposed to be in and not floating in different levels and all of those like really precise techniques are very applicable to, I would say, like a lot of contemporary fine dining. I don't know so much about, you know, contemporary casual, but
that's actually,
you know, like all of those techniques are very transportable, I think, to modern cooking.
It's another question entirely, I think, like if the relationship between Nate as a polytechnic and the, you know, hospitality industry in Edmonton and Alberta, it's like, well, do those techniques really support people who are trying to enter that industry or who are trying to advance in the industry? Like, I don't know if that's the most useful skill that we could be teaching them as opposed to some, like, and just to be kind of pedantic about it, like, would it be more useful if they spend the time, you know, just like cooking more steaks or, sorry, do you know what I mean? Like in the repetition.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. So, like, should they be learning how to make smash burgers instead because that's what people are buying? Like, I don't know.
Garde manger, but like it's kind of like beyond my pay grade, but that is something that I think about. But certainly, because like, even within Edmonton, like even the, I don't know, fine dining in Edmonton is a very different thing than, you know, the cookbooks that you and I read. So I think it's definitely valuable because it teaches technique and it opens your mind to what is possible. It's another argument entirely. You know, how valuable each skill is, I guess, if you're trying to cater to a domestic industry. But
I hear you. Although I think it depends on the individual and what their potential career path is. And, you know, so that's, I think that especially for someone who's taking like a 2-year program, like you want a broad range of techniques because you don't exactly know where that person is headed or, you know, what their career path might be. And so you want to give them as much fundamental skill as possible to build on. Right.
Yep. And so that's one of my goals, not that the instructors who have done it before have avoided this, but I really do want to try and make it feel contemporary and, or at least show how it can be used in a contemporary way and not have it feel archaic.
Totally. And so to that end, have you started to write menus for it or?
Well, yeah, I've written the menu. Because for this course, the menu is not an afterthought, but it's like not, it's a much smaller part of the course as a whole compared to evening dining. Do you want me to, and I've tried to just like chunk as many of the learning objectives into it as possible. Do you want to hear it or?
Right. Yeah, sure. But just out of curiosity, are there things like, are there, that's the right way to say this. Are there dishes and techniques that are going to be made in the course that will never wind up on the lunch service? Or is like, is the menu, is there enough stuff on the menu that all of the outcomes are covered, I guess?
At the learning objective level, all of the objectives appear on the menu right now.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. And just to qualify that, the menu being there's our a la carte menu, which is Monday through Thursday, but then there's also the buffet
right
on Friday. And so for instance, there is not a pâté on the menu, on the a la carte menu.
But there is one on the buffet.
But there will always
so between the two menus.
There will always be pâtés and terrines on the buffet menu, does that make sense?
Yep.
So the a la carte menu, and I've just drafted it and it's been approved, but I haven't cooked any of it. And so I just need to make sure that it all makes sense in terms of like bill times and procurement and stuff like that. But so I'm going to give you a really high level look at it first.
Okay.
One of the outcomes is salads, right, Shale?
Yeah. That's part of the first outcome.
So yeah. We have a basically the way that salads are described in the course text, there's green salads and there's side salads. So basically there's green salads and there's everything else.
And then
every
pasta
other
salad.
Kind of
I got it.
Yeah.
Don't worry, Alan. I'm
marinated anything. Vegetables, pasta. Yeah.
Okay, you tell me then, what's a Greek salad, Alan? Is that a green salad or is that...
That's not classical. We don't do that. I'm just kidding. Okay. It's not French. I'm just kidding. So the structure of the menu, I was hoping to do seven appetizers. And so there's a green salad and then there's a quote side salad, like a marinated vegetable salad. And then just to cram a bunch of the techniques from the cured and smoked and sausage objective, there's something that we're just calling a charcuterie tasting that will have a few elements that I'll come back to. For cured and smoked foods, we have a smoked Arctic char rillette. I wanted a cheese centric course because cheese is one of the outcomes. And so there'll be a cheese centric course, for us,
goat cheese fondue.
That could be a thing, not on this menu, but that's a good idea. I'll write it on the brainstorm list.
Okay, fair enough.
Sausage is a big part of one of the outcomes. So there's going to be a sausage focused menu item. And then...
hot dog.
That's on the list already, actually.
Okay.
And then that really broad outcome of pâté, terrine, galantine, roulade.
Yeah.
I'd like something from that on the menu. And so I do have a galantine on this one. So I've the other objectives like appetizers, like these are all appetizers. So that checks the box. And then when we do a buffet service, that will check the box. So,
right.
And then okay. I'll just tell you the full menu as it is right now, there's going to be a butterleaf salad, but it's going to be like a BLT inspired butterleaf salad. So butterleaf salad with, maybe Gull Valley tomato, a bacon cornmeal crumble, buttermilk dressing, dill and chive. And it's funny to me because it checks the green salad box that a lot of people are expecting, but also it's not even vegetarian, let alone vegan. But I think it'll be really tasty because it's like bacon, lettuce, and tomato. And then for the quote side salad, the like marinated vegetable style salad, I want to do something that's like like a German Gemüsestrudel or like even like a Greek or Moroccan like salad combination where it's just like a few different kinds of marinated vegetables that are set side by side by side on a plate.
Gotcha.
So the way it's written right now, it just says marinated vegetable tasting. And so we have cucumbers with sumac, roasted eggplant with sesame, and oven dried tomatoes with pumpkin seed pesto. And this could change through the season, whatever kind of vegetables we have available to us, but just like in some kind of like really punchy marinade and presented in a really colorful way with lots of textures. Next, so that was marinated vegetable tasting. And then next, a charcuterie tasting, where we just have a few different in-house cured and smoked and whatever preparations. And so to start, we're going to try doing a kielbasa in like a, I don't even know what the official word for this is, but like an Alberta style Ukrainian sausage, like a ham sausage, right, like mundare, a smoked bison jerky and a chicken liver mousse that has a fruit gelée cap that we've talked about a dozen times on this show because working with gelatin is one of the objectives for the course.
Totally.
And then just served with pickled vegetables and rye bread. I would love to figure out a way to serve that on a little piece of wood. I have a whole bunch on hand from some of the businesses and operations that I've been associated with in the past, but they might be too small for this. I don't know, but we serve stuff like that at Zaltz and at Eat Alberta events.
Right.
Smoked Arctic char rillette with, say, sunflower seed crackers and pickled beets and pea shoots. For the cheese course right now, I was thinking of a cheese blintz. So some kind of fresh cheese like that we make because they're supposed to be able to make some of the fresh and unripened cheeses in the lab.
Yeah.
Make a fromage
frais. So are you going to do like an actual like rennet set, like farmer's cheese or something like that?
Yeah, it might not. The first thing I was going to try was just fromage frais. So that would be not rennet set, but like lactic acid set. Kind of like the classic line cook creme fraiche situation. Like leaving heavy cream and buttermilk on top of a dehydrator kind of thing.
Totally.
But there is an opportunity to do a rennet set one. I'm basically picturing this like a variation of something that we did at June's, where it's like a pretty standard, just straight buckwheat crepe, really tidy fold around a fresh cheese and just frying it in butter. And for this one, just for like freshness and texture, like making a kind of, you can picture like a salsa that's like, or I think what someone I work with at Nate is always talking about masa duan, like just like a really tidy, tidy knife work assembly of, for in this case, apple, or like raw apple, walnut, and tarragon or something. But then like fine enough and sauced in such a way that you could make a quenelle out of it or something like that.
Right.
But anyways, yeah, buckwheat crepe.
That's a tricky thing to pull off with apples.
Yeah, you gotta, I don't know. Yeah. You have to add something that will stick them together, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, and keep them from, like you have to protect them from oxidation in a way that's like that I think in most cases just regular like acidulated water doesn't really do a good enough job of.
Yeah, you know? They did a good one at Naramata when I was there, and it was basically like fine dice apples with pickled mustard seed and shallot and herbs. But but you had to do it every day. Like you had to, at the very least, the apple component had to be done every day.
Of course.
So we'll see. It's one of those things where it's like you write a menu and it sounds great and you know it will taste good, but then if the logistics don't work out, then you have to adapt. But
right. I just a quick recommend for you if you're trying to figure that out. If you vac seal your apples not too hard with malic acid and a little bit of apple juice, might be the might be a good trick.
Do you mean like dice them and then do that, or do you mean?
Yeah, you don't want to pull too hard a vacuum because you don't want to misshape them.
Right. But, oh, okay.
But just like to get all of the air out.
Yeah.
And then apply a little bit of extra malic acid to them.
And that would last.
That was the that was a Noma technique.
How long does that, like, would that last a week or?
I mean, we were doing them daily.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But it really made it so that they were like perfect, like, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a dish, I was on an old Noma menu, but where they were like standing up, they were like taking slices of apple and making like a little cylinder out of them. And those were like standing up all over the plate. And then I can't remember what the dish was actually, strangely. But yeah, I know that we were making slices of apple and then sealing them in apple juice with added malic acid.
Right. Okay. Yeah. For the sausage forward dish, I was hoping you'd do a Scotch egg. Like bring in small eggs, which we...
Small.
Well, you know what I mean? Like not,
I know what you mean.
Not,
I know
not
you mean
quail small eggs.
Size chicken eggs.
Yeah, small-sized chicken eggs, yeah.
Small, the robin's eggs.
And right, exactly. And then, wrap them. The idea for this dish is to wrap them in like... kind of like a spicy fennel Italian. This is, basically, the idea is sausage and peppers and so, in a Scotch egg form. So a sweet. Fennel, kind of spicy fennel pork sausage around the little chicken egg. And to serve it maybe with frisée and a pepperonata, like a grilled pepper, tomato, onion kind of salsa situation. And I don't
I've had your Scotch eggs before and they crush. So that's okay. Exciting.
Thank you, Shale. Sorry, I didn't mean to make that sound sarcastic at all. and then lastly, this is the one I'm most skeptical about. This the idea of serving a galantine, like a chicken galantine, like a nice little 2 or 3 ounce portion of a chicken, like a nice round chicken galantine, like skin on the outside, lean meat beyond below that, and then like some kind of farce. In the center. I'm just worried about the time it takes to sear and heat something like that. And also for the flavors, this was just like kind of like a placeholder, but I wrote lemon rosemary mousseline, so that's the filling of the galantine. And then butternut squash and cranberry. And so I didn't really think it through. Like it could be a
flesh it out that much.
Squash puree and a cranberry. Like I don't know. I didn't think it through. Yeah. But it was just like.
I wonder. Like you have a rationale, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if it would be possible to do it pretty well in a rationale without having to like sear it in a pan and stuff like that. Just like have a time and temp for it.
Yeah. So the way, like, the only way that I've served galantine previously was as a, like, it's a hot entree. And so we would cook we had the whole kind of cylinder of the galantine. And it was cooked in the rationale, wrapped in foil.
Right.
And the rationale.
And then cut into slices and then.
Yeah. Right. And then, so like the skin was pretty well rendered in the initial cooking. And then you could just, when it was on order, you would do your best to like kind of roll it around the pan so that you sear and fully render and crisp the skin.
The skin,
And then it's already fully cooked and you just need to warm it in the oven. And that was fine for a entree situation. But if like basically our cook times for anything for these appetizers needs to be 10 minutes or less.
Right, yeah.
And so I don't know, even if it's a half size of the galantine cylinders that I've done in the past. I don't know if 10 minutes is enough. I don't know. Maybe I'm just overthinking it, but.
Yeah. I think, potentially. Yeah. As long as the skin is well rendered and stuff. And if you do it in a hot oven and maybe if there's a way to like cover up the ends of the slice so that they don't get overly browned or something like that. And then you can do most of the work in the oven and then maybe just torch it a little bit or something. I don't know.
Yeah. It's not a fully thought out dish yet. It was just like a Because even when
that's
I read that.
That's a good one, because I think that's, you know, like that's something that will be challenging and that you know, people aren't going to have a lot of exposure to. That one sounds like a real good learning experience to me.
Yeah. Because yeah. I think it, like the, just those components, like I can sort of picture a presentation, but even still, it's like chicken and pureed squash and cranberry sauce. Like there's nothing crisp. There's nothing like, well, it's got acid, I guess that's mm-hmm. good, but like, there's nothing like really, I don't know. There's nothing like addictive yeah. about it. I mean, like something like that right. really yeah, catches, yeah, yeah. like really sexy that catches your attention. But
yeah, but yeah, totally. Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. I'm sure that you don't have to roll this out until what, September, right? So
yeah, I've got a little bit.
You've got some time to, yeah.
Yeah. yeah. So anyways, that's the, and so that's the, that would be the potential a la carte menu. Buffets are kind of a different beast entirely. Like there's a,
right.
I've inherited like the kind of production list that they've done for the buffets over the years. And it has obviously like hot hors d'oeuvres and cold hors d'oeuvres and yeah, pâtés and terrines, sausages, so many salads, cheese boards, charcuterie boards, that kind of thing.
Sounds fancy.
Oh yeah. Oh, you should come. You should come to one. Have you ever been to one?
I have never been to one. And I was just gonna ask you, like, is it as hard to get into as dinner or
maybe more so, Shale?
I don't know. Yeah, that's what I was worried about.
they do book up fast.
Yeah.
But I think at the beginning of a school year, they have all of the dates. Well, even now, they have all of the dates for these buffets decided
right.
for the entire next academic year. So
if only I knew someone who could get me a seat.
What? Just there's a number on the
if
website.
I had like
just
an inside connection or something.
I'm not sure I've ever actually attended one, to be honest, but
really?
Yeah. But yeah, they're very popular.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard people talk about them like it's a well-kept secret or something like that. But, I don't think it's that well-kept. I think, I think a lot of people know about it. It's just like, there's only so many seats in that place.
Right. Yeah. Like they cap. Yeah. I don't know what the number, they cap them at 120 or something. And yep, they only happen. Right. They're not every Friday because they like when there's a new batch of students, they
skip a week.
Yeah,
or whatever,
exactly. Then, so it's, there's probably only 12 a year or something, but.
Okay. 12 a year.
No, more than that. Sorry. Smokes. I was just doing math in my head. There's more than 12 a year. Sorry. But
okay.
There's not 50 a year, Shale. Somewhere between 12
but there's
and 50.
Somewhere around 23 a year.
Somewhere between 12 and 50. Don't worry about it.
Okay, cool. yeah, sounds good. Do you, and so like, are you apprehensive about having to teach like a wholly different format? Do you feel like it's going to be a lot? Like it seems like the way that the food is prepared isn't going to be so heavily, service oriented, right? Like the food will wind up being used for the service, but like, is it going to be more like teaching a class than it previously has been while you've been doing evening dining? Like, is it going to be like, okay, everyone, today we're going to learn how to make this preparation? Or,
well, I think there's going to be a lot more of that kind of thing. And the right. way, so, and the person who's been teaching this class for the last 3 years has been Kelsey Johnson. I don't know if we've
okay.
mentioned her on the podcast before, but we both know her. Like the former chef and part owner of Cafe Linnea.
Yeah.
And
amazing
so
chef.
Most of the stuff that I've inherited has been from her. And I know that you're right. Like most of the production that happens in the class either ends up being served at the a la carte services or at the buffet or at the, like, it, for instance, if there's surplus production of sausages or something like that, they get sold at the artisan market that's on campus.
Yeah.
But there is much more of the way that Kelsey has done it. There is like a formal lecture at the start of each class. Like today, right. our lecture is on pâtés and terrines, and today our lecture right. is on cheese production, which I didn't have to do at all an evening dining, really. Like, there, we did an orientation, but then everything else, all of the instruction related to the menu that had been written, and there wasn't like a theory component. Do you know what I mean? It was just,
yeah, it's like you're a chef and you have a whole kitchen full of new hires and you have to teach them how to do a restaurant service.
Right. Yeah.
That was evening dining.
And obviously there is theory and technique in that training, but it wasn't actually like there was no dedicated outcome related to those techniques besides make this service work and serve this menu. But here there is more of a formal educational component where there are techniques here that the student, some of these techniques the students have seen before, like they've done a kind of preliminary cold kitchen course, but they haven't.
And probably a preliminary sauces course or something.
I don't know about cold. Well, sorry, the cold sauces, there would have been an element of that in their cold kitchen course as well.
Oh, okay.
And they do a formal, like their soup and vegetable course would have had sauces, like all of the mother sauces would have been introduced there, but those are all hot sauces, right? So yes, they've made mayonnaise before. Yes, they've made salads before. I think a lot of the charcuterie and pâtés and terrines component is new to them, but... Mm. And actually, yeah, I'm actually really excited for that part of it because I do like public speaking and presentation and Shale, I love PowerPoints. I haven't had to make a PowerPoint since I was in high school, but I've got them all queued up for the students.
Surely there's something better than PowerPoint by now. There's got to be something else that's like the de facto standard for how you give a presentation. It can't still be PowerPoint. There's no way. PowerPoint's so bad. Something else must have come along and taken its place.
PowerPoint isn't so bad. Just people don't use it very well. But but yeah, my presentations won't be TikTok based. They'll be PowerPoint based. Sorry.
Good luck keeping my attention with that, Al.
But in terms of like any kind of apprehension of teaching a new course, I don't have much, sorry, not to sound too arrogant, but a lot of this is really, really in my wheelhouse. Like the smoked cured sausage, pâté, terrine, cheese, like I has been something that I've loved and been have done in industry for many years. I'm kind of boning up on some of the I like eating cheese, but I haven't made a lot of cheese, and so I'm boning up on things like the cheese making process for like rennet set cheese and stuff like that. But
I would say too, I don't know if it's like a passion of yours, but you also have a lot of experience putting out buffets, so that's
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny trying to refocus on like the cold part of a buffet, because it's always just been like, we have to do a buffet service. And so you do everything for that. And so it'll be a little bit different, like just focusing, I guess, on pâtés and cheese and salads and stuff like that. But yeah, I do think I understand the planning and structure of a buffet service pretty well, but
For sure.
But yeah, it is fun to kind of go back and make sure you cover all those bases, and it's gonna be a good fall.
So what's your favorite, what's the dish on your menu that you're most excited about right now, like getting to teach?
The dish, the one that I'm most excited to teach is the charcuterie tasting, because there's so many things jam-packed onto it, like a Alberta Mundare style kielbasa is like...
Yeah, I've never made anything like that
a
before.
A lecture in itself, and a chicken liver mousse with a fruit gelée cap is a lecture unto itself.
Do you want me to come in and like demo that for
you?
Do
you mind? Or
no, I wouldn't
can
mind.
I take the day off if you do that, or...
Yeah, probably. Okay. I don't know how it works over there, but
that's the most exciting one to me to introduce, like to explain. The one I'm most excited to eat is either the Scotch egg or the blintz. Because I haven't, sweet, yeah. I mean, I hope they, yeah, they'll turn out okay, right?
They'll be great.
Because
you'll have it.
I know we've
down.
Got a great sausage recipe that makes sense with a pepperonata salsa, and the cheese blintz. I don't know. That was one of my favorite things that we did at June's. Like it was just so pretty and tidy. Tasted great, and it was like the perfect balance of sweet and savory. So I don't know, those are the ones that I want to eat again. But
sweet. Two more things. Is there any component of the course where you actually are having to use product from other kitchens that would normally, you know, like that are actual like offcuts and things that are like waste that isn't going to be used by any of the other kitchens? Is there, you know, like, because that's sort of like the, you know, historical function of garde manger is like reusing the food, the expensive food that you don't want to go to waste from like the rest of the kitchen, finding ways to preserve that and turn it into dishes that can be value added for your menu or whatever. Is there anything like that? Or is it basically you're just ordering what you need to make the dishes that you're going to make?
There's not a formal component of the class in that. I've tried to write the menu in a way that we could do that internally within the class. So like there's not not a cut of meat that couldn't be used in another dish, for instance. Like like we've got chicken liver mousse. There shouldn't ever really be trim from the livers that couldn't go into a mousse, but if there were, it could end up in the chicken galantine filling, like that kind of thing. There actually is a class in the program right now that does deal with that specifically.
Oh, cool.
There's one of the fourth semester classes right now is called sustainability, and there's theoretical components about it, like how to design menus and reduce food waste and all that. But they do literally like take unused food from other labs and repurpose them either for the artisan market or for other outlets.
Cool.
So yeah, I think you're right. Like even though it's not a explicit outcome of the course, like it is an important, not just an important historic part of garde manger, but one that, should be taught and understood.
Yeah, totally. And then I guess like my other question is like, you know, how are you're going to have like, you know, a diverse set of students, and this seems like very Western food. Is there going to be, because I know like in the evening dining class there were like, you know, there was like palate cleanser or like specials and things that students would get to do, or they can incorporate maybe some like of their cultural influence and things like that. Is there any way to incorporate any of that into this menu, or is it just going to be like, okay, welcome to third semester, you're cooking nothing but white boy food?
Well, I mean, if pâtés and terrines are white boy food to you, then no. I think like honestly, I think in this class there will be more opportunity for that than there was in evening dining. We did like student feature menus, either on a dish by dish basis or sometimes like as a table d'hote kind of prefix thing.
Right
now we'll see. Like I'm kind of going into it a little bit blind, but the way it's been structured for many years is that there's a set menu through the week. Maybe there's some kind of opportunity for a student feature, but the buffets are largely student driven, and the buffets will often have themes, and often like either like regional, like world regional themes. Like we're going to be doing, cool. Yeah. Like I've seen everything from, you know, French to Southern states to Southeast Asian to whatever, like these kinds of themes for the buffets.
Cool. And Filipino, you roast the whole pig?
They have, yeah. Oh, sorry, like I
really,
you know, that I haven't done buffet services at lunchtime, but they have done. Yeah. I don't know if it was a Filipino menu or like a Southeast Asian menu, but they have brought in suckling pigs to roast for the buffets.
Wow, that's crazy. Cool.
So I have to kind of like feel it out and, you know, but if they've been doing it for years, then I don't see why I would mess with it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is like the major outlet of not only student creativity and input, but also like helping expose them to world food and yeah, things that aren't, you know, Northern French, bloomy rind, soft ripened cheeses, but also everything else that exists on planet Earth.
Yeah. Cool. Well, that's exciting. I'm really excited for you that you get to like tackle this whole other kind of, you know, this whole new thing. And, you know, it's still a ways away and it sounds like you've already done a lot of digging into it and a lot of planning and a lot of thinking about it. So that's exciting.
Thanks, Shell.
Are you doing all that so that you don't have to think about it all summer? Is that the...
Well, that's the idea. Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. And I can't wait to eat it once we get there.
Me too. I hope it tastes good.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.